Hello, it's Monday the 11th of October and welcome to Korea 24. I'm your host, Kwon Jang-woo. The Gyeonggi Province Governor Lee Jae-myung has been elected as the ruling Democratic Party's candidate for next year's presidential election. We'll have the full details in our news briefing shortly. Amid rising tensions between the US and China, the White House has revealed that a virtual summit is being planned between the leaders by the end of the year. We'll discuss what could be on the agenda for our in-depth today. Plus, Sunday saw two Korean golfers win titles in both the PGA and LPGA. We'll have more on Monday's sports roundup later. Let's begin Korea 24. It has been confirmed Gyeonggi Governor Lee Jae-myung is the ruling Democratic Party's candidate for next year's presidential election. To give us more details on the presidential hopeful, as well as our other headlines of the day, we have with us in the studio a new voice on our show today, KBS World Radio News Editor Anthony Casey. Hello, Anthony. Welcome to the show.
Hello, Jang Ho. Nice to be here.
So it appears the ruling Democratic Party have made their choice now when it comes to next year's presidential election. Can you tell us more?
Yes, indeed. It appears they have. Gyeonggi Governor Lee Jae-myung was elected as the ruling Democratic Party's candidate for next year's presidential election, set to be held on March 9th. Lee secured the presidential ticket on Sunday after winning 50.29% of the votes from regional primaries held from September 4th until Sunday, and three rounds of votes among members of the public. While the governor was widely projected to win with around 56% of votes, he did so with a narrow margin after securing 28.3% in the third round of public votes, against former DP leader Lee Nak-yon's 62.3%. The former leader came in second with 39.14% of total votes. This outcome comes amid favoritism and corruption allegations surrounding a land development project in Songam, Gyeonggi Province, launched in 2015 when the governor was mayor of the city.
But still, that doesn't seem to have slowed down his race. Anyway, that's the ruling centre-left party. They've made their presidential candidate choice now. What about the main opposition party?
Well, the main opposition party are still whittling down the prospective candidates. The People Power Party will launch a four-week-long primary on Monday with a televised debate in southwestern province of Jeolla.
So four contenders, Hong Joon-pyo, Yoon Suk-yeol, Yoo Seung-min and Won Il-rung, were previously chosen through two rounds of cutoffs. So what happens next?
Following Monday's debate, the candidates will participate in nine additional rounds. The final candidate is expected to be named on November 5th based on combined results of a public survey and party member votes.
Let's continue on now and turn our attention to COVID-19. It appears we have hit a significant milestone with regards to vaccinations. What can you tell us?
Yes, a bit of good news. So the number of people who have received at least one dose of the COVID-19 vaccine in South Korea has now surpassed the 40 million mark. The government's vaccine task force said that this landmark was reached as of 4 p.m. Monday. This comes on the 228th day of the country's vaccination program, which began on February 26. As of this afternoon, those who have been inoculated at least once stands at 40,006,549, accounting for 77.9% of the entire population, of 90.6% of the population aged 18 or over.
Well, that's very promising indeed. Any other developments that might help further increase the number of vaccinated people?
So the authorities stated that those over the age of 18 who have yet to receive their first shot can get inoculated through a same-day reservation system from Monday. Previously, only no-show vaccines were available as same-day vaccine reservations. People wishing to get vaccinated should check with vaccination centres for availability. The State Vaccine Task Force said this decision comes as the country tries to provide the opportunity for the remaining 5.3 million adults to receive their shots swiftly and to raise the vaccination rate for those over the age of 60 who have a higher chance of developing severe cases.
On that note, let's get an update on the COVID situation here in South Korea. What's the daily count like today?
So the daily COVID-19 cases in South Korea remained under 2,000 for the third day, largely attributed to fewer tests over the long weekend. According to the Korea Disease Control and Prevention Agency, 1,297 COVID-19 cases were detected throughout Sunday, raising the accumulated caseload to 332,816. Of the new cases, 1,284 were local transmissions, while 13 were from overseas. The capital region accounted for 73.1% of local cases, including 509 confirmed in Seoul and 358 in Gyeonggi Province. 8 deaths have been reported, raising the death toll to 2,583. The fatality rate stands at 0.78%. And the number of critically ill patients dropped by 6 from the previous day to 371.
Okay, now let's take a look north of the border. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un has been seen in public. What's been happening there?
Well, it's been rather eventful. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un pledged to resolve the country's chronic shortages of basic necessities, such as clothing, food and housing, over the next 5 years, as he marked the 76th anniversary of the founding of the ruling Workers' Party.
OK, so he's looking to improve the quality of life for North Koreans. Where did he make this announcement and why?
According to the North Korean, the North state-run Korean Central News Agency, on Monday, Kim made the pledge during a special lecture at an anniversary event the previous day. Kim reaffirmed a 5-year national economic plan set forth at a party congress in January, which is aimed at development and improving people's livelihoods. The leader urged the party officials to always consider whether their work infringes upon public interests and to prioritise and respect all members of the public.
Any mention of South Korea or the US?
Well, there was no mention from Kim directed towards South Korea or the United States.
In related news, it appears that the US and China are talking again with regards to the Korean Peninsula issues. What have the envoys had to say in this latest development?
Yes, nuclear envoys from the United States and China discussed the security situation surrounding North Korea over the phone. According to China's foreign ministry on Sunday, Korean Peninsula Affairs Special Representative Liu Xiaoming and US Special Representative for North Korea Sung Kim held their first phone talks in 3 months, a day earlier. After delivering Beijing's position on the situation, Lee urged Washington to give more attention to Pyongyang's legitimate and reasonable concerns and to take concrete action to create conditions for the resumption of constructive dialogue. Affirming US commitment to a diplomatic resolution of peninsula issues, Kim expressed hope for a swift resumption of dialogue and contact with the North. The two officials have agreed to maintain ongoing communication.
We'll leave it there for our news briefing today. Thank you for those updates.
Oh, no problem. Thank you.
It was revealed last week that US President Joe Biden and his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping are planning to hold a virtual bilateral meeting before the end of the year. According to the White House, the agreement in principle came after US National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan and China's top diplomat Yang Jiechi met in the Swiss city of Zurich last Wednesday. Relations between Washington and Beijing have been locked in a stalemate in recent years, but they've recently been exacerbated by Beijing's aggressive posture towards Taiwan. To get some expert analysis on the current situation between the two global powers, we're joined on the line by Mason Ritchie, Associate Professor of International Politics at Hangul University of Foreign Studies. Professor Ritchie, welcome to the show.
Great, thanks for having me.
So US officials said that virtual meeting was being scheduled in part to follow up the phone call between Biden and Xi back on September 9th, their second such call since Biden took office in January. The virtual meeting, if materialized, would mark the first time the two leaders would hold a formal meeting since Biden became president. So what do you make of this latest development?
Well, I think it's positive. I think it's really important right now for the United States and China to manage their competition and rivalry. And this meeting, I think, is an important part of doing that, notably through reducing risks in numerous areas of potential misperception and miscalculation and in numerous flashpoints, including especially Taiwan. The last few weeks and even few months have seen some heightened tension, not only over Taiwan, but also over a few other issues as well. Although most recently and perhaps most starkly, the problem has been with Taiwan. And poor communication doesn't help, and that's unfortunately been the case also. The U.S. side has complained about not having access to their counterparts, that their counterparts are giving mostly talking points rather than engaging in a real give and take. And so insofar as Xi Jinping really holds most of the power, if not all of the power, in the CCP, which ultimately is responsible for running China, Biden, I think, needs to be able to speak with Xi so that he can get Xi to set the tone for the people under him to do a better job of communicating with the U.S. There has been recent friction over Taiwan's air defense identification zone, U.S. military trainers in Taiwan, trade spats, climate change, even North Korea. So all of those things might show up in some form on the agenda. That being said, I wouldn't expect any significant breakthroughs on any of those issues.
Right. When asked for further details, the White House spokeswoman, Jen Psaki, said that the two sides are still working through what the virtual meeting would look like, adding that they don't have final details yet. What do you think it will look like, and what do you think will be on the agenda for the virtual meeting in more detail?
Yeah, so you know, what makes it on the agenda will be a function of a few things, the first of which is when will precisely the meeting take place. We don't know that yet. They've only said before the end of the year. A lot can happen in between now and whenever it is that they choose to set up this meeting. The other thing, of course, will be what types of events happen in between now and also how much time they're going to have to be able to talk. Will this be an hour? Will it be 2 hours? Will it be 3 hours? How are they going to set this meeting up? How much time will it take? And since we don't have dates and we don't have links yet, it's a bit hard to say. I think clearly Taiwan is going to be at the top of the agenda list. And, of course, the U.S. And China will be looking at this extremely differently. The U.S. will clearly bring up Chinese fighter jets and bombers that have entered in increasing numbers into Taiwan's air defense identification zone over the last week or so, although this has been on a smaller scale, a problem going back for many months. On the Chinese side, they're obviously very upset about the revelation of the fact that the U.S. has had some of its special forces and other military expert trainers in Taiwan training the Taiwanese military. Which from a Taiwanese perspective, from a Chinese perspective, insofar as they consider Taiwan to be a province of China, is tantamount, in fact, to U.S. soldiers being stationed on Chinese territory. Mm. Obviously, that's significant. We've seen the Biden administration recently talk about the fact that essentially they're going to keep in place much of President Trump's trade sanctions on China and overall trade philosophy with China. So clearly China, I think, will want to address that. The U.S. side, of course, will also want to talk about climate change and what type of cooperation they might expect. So I think that there'll be a sort of sounding out for what some of China's priorities will be for some of these issues.
So as you mentioned, tensions have been ratcheting up, especially over Taiwan. But still, why now? Why has the talk of a summit come now? Obviously, we don't know the exact dates of when it might happen, but what do you think the two leaders are hoping to get out of a virtual meeting?
I think the U.S. In the first place really just wants to set the tone on communications and, as much as anything else, try to get some top-down order among the ranks of the counterparts in the CCP of the U.S. senior officials, which I think they think is going to be really important to managing risks, particularly if some type of crisis were to happen. So I think that that's a significant part of it, just basically getting a first shot under Biden at managing tensions within this great power competition. The U.S. Has just recently had an attack submarine, in the South China Sea, which hit some unidentified object. So far as I know, we still don't know what that is, but there's been quite a bit of speculation that it might have been, for instance, an underwater drone. And if that were an underwater drone from China, China might complain about that as being unsafe. The U.S. might complain about that as being unsafe. And that could, be the type of situation that could spiral and perhaps escalate out of control under certain circumstances. So, that collision, and again, it might have been trash or something natural, but it could also have been a drone or something like that. But it's just a reminder that it's very easy for this relationship potentially to spiral out of control if you don't have good communications. On the Chinese side, I think they're going to want to set some clear red lines and communicate to Washington that they don't plan on being flexible on things that they consider to be absolutely vital to their interests, including especially Taiwan, their territorial claims in the South China Sea. And then, of course, also the One China policy. They're going to want Biden to reinforce the fact that the United States will continue to abide by the One China policy.
Now, some analysts have expressed doubt that this meeting will go ahead, saying that a virtual meeting is easier to call off than an in-person one. Do you have such concerns as well?
I do think it's easier probably to call off a virtual meeting rather than an in-person meeting, if for no other reason than an in-person meeting carries with it a significant amount of down payment in terms of time and energy put into preparing the meetings and finding the locations and advanced scout teams and the security aspects. All of those things are pretty important, and they represent a sunk cost, whereas a virtual meeting in some ways seems like perhaps it doesn't require so many sunk costs. I think that the meeting could be canceled if crisis events mean that one side or the other could lose face. One side or the other believes that the other side isn't serious about having a meaningful conversation, and that this is just a dilatory tactic, for some other strategy or some ulterior motive. And in the U.S.'s case, of course, Biden has to pay attention to political sensitivities. Depending on when this meeting were to take place, you would be looking at getting close to the calendar year or even within the calendar year before the next midterm general election comes. And China is a really hot button issue, of course, in the United States. And so Biden, has to make sure that he's shoring up his Democratic Party as they're, in terms of foreign policy, as they're heading in to a pretty difficult election season.
Now, earlier you mentioned that North Korea could perhaps be on the agenda for the talks as well. How much of a factor do you think North Korea could be for the two countries for the talks are moving ahead as well?
At first glance, it doesn't seem like North Korea is a high priority. The Biden administration, differently from the Trump administration, has clearly not gambled on significant face-to-face diplomacy between the U.S. president and Chairman Kim, and we're not even sure if Chairman Kim is very interested in that either. That being said, North Korea could be on the agenda. If it is, I think it would, in the first place, be a function of the length of the meeting. Presumably it will come up in some form, but more or less regardless. But how much time the leaders actually spend talking about that, I think, depends on how long the meeting is and whether or not there's sufficient place for North Korea to make it onto the agenda in a significant way. If it does, I think there will be some constellation of issues involving sanctions enforcement. The U.S. would clearly want China to do a better job in enforcing sanctions. China would probably reply with the fact that it would like to see Washington move somewhat on supporting diplomatic efforts at peace and reconciliation, including all different types of measures to help South Korea with its efforts to cooperate with North Korea. And in particular, I think asking the United States to perhaps be a bit more flexible on some of its sanctions demands and requirements. And then I think thirdly, you know, clearly China, but also you know, the U.S. will make you know calls for stability and diplomacy going forward. Overall, you know, the Korean Peninsula is less prominent theme under Biden than it was under Trump. Mm. And it's really more of a piece of the larger U.S.-China puzzle. So to the extent that it makes it into the puzzle, it's going to be a relatively small piece of the meeting, I think, rather than a large one.
Sure. And also, what about South Korean President Moon Jae-in's call to formally end the Korean War, which North Korea has responded positively to? Can that be achieved when the U.S. and China are facing such heightened tensions and at loggerheads with each other?
Well, you know, in the first place, I think actually, you know, inter-Korean peace and reconciliation, you know, including a peace declaration and a formal end of the Korean War, you know, are issues that North and South Korea don't particularly agree on either. You know, North Korea has also expressed quite a bit of skepticism about this idea. Sometimes they're more receptive to it than others. So, you know, quite apart from the U.S.-China relationship, you know, the two Koreas, you know, they have their own problems to deal with before they're able to arrive at that point. And Moon, obviously, is, if not already a lame duck, you know, moving fairly quickly towards that as we're getting ready for the March presidential election. So he has extremely limited political capital. Pyongyang obviously knows that. And so, you know, I think that there will be some type of diplomatic push that will come out of the Moon administration, and presumably it will get some type of reception from Pyongyang. One imagines they might be slipping into a more reconciliation or at least dialogue-oriented position currently, and that they might run a bit hot and cold, be relatively friendly and then relatively cool, you know, relatively open to dialogue, but perhaps backstopping that occasionally with some tests or some other verbal provocations. But at some point, you think that South North Korea might end up indeed taking up South Korea on its offer of beginning to talk about, again, some of these inter-Korean issues, including a peace declaration. And from the Moon perspective, I think it would clearly help him if that were, for instance, to be hooked into a larger event such as the Olympics next year, the Winter Olympics next year in Beijing. Mm. So I think it would be easier for South Korea to pull that off. Indeed, if the U.S. and China were in an easier place where the Olympics would go off without a hitch, and it would make it easier for South Korea to somehow, you know, put this in a larger context of regional improvement on security and stability.
And finally, Professor, going back to the larger U.S.-China picture, how do you think the situation is going to pan out in the coming months ahead? How far is China willing to test the U.S., and how does the U.S. respond as well?
Well, that's a difficult question. I certainly don't have access to Xi Jinping's mind. I would say this in general. You know, there's sort of two schools of thought about why it is that China is being relatively aggressive at the moment, whether that be diplomatically with Taiwan, or whether that be the larger what we call wolf warrior diplomacy, which is a sort of highly aggressive and nationalist diplomacy that's not only active in the East Asia region or the Indo-Pacific region, but also globally, or whether it be Taiwan and this most recent series of incursions into Taiwan's ADIZ. And one of those schools of thought is essentially that, you know, China, for instance, is setting the stage for invading Taiwan, that it's setting the stage potentially for military conflict, and that, this is a part of that effort. The other school of thought is really that, you know, China's in this for the long haul, rather, and for the long term, and that, in fact, what it's doing in terms of putting pressure on Taiwan right now is actually a sign that conflict is not imminent, although we've seen people say that, you know, perhaps China's, you know, looking to invade Taiwan by 2025 or so. But in fact, you know, some people think that's not the case, and rather that the current aggressiveness that we're seeing is really about breaking down over the long term Taipei's resistance and willpower to continuing to claim to remain independent. And you know, which of those two schools of thought I think are correct, you know, we'll find out, you know, within the next few years. I don't, however, necessarily think that we're going to see, you know, big changes within the next few months. That being said, China does have a limited time frame for some of its ultimate goals. It has demographic issues to deal with. It has economic issues to deal with. And so at the very least, I think we can expect, you know, China to maintain pressure on Taiwan, and that will continue to be a flashpoint that the U.S. will have to be very wary of and careful with over the coming months, if not years.
Professor, thank you very much for your insights today. We've been speaking to Mason Ritchie from the Hanguk University of Foreign Studies. Thank you once again for your time.
Great. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
It is a holiday in Korea today, the alternative holiday for Hangul Day, which fell on Saturday, which means the stock markets are closed, so no stock market update today, and instead we skip straight into our daily segment, Korea Trending. Kujimbita Walter Lee has joined us now to bring us some of the other news stories that have been trending online today. Walter, hello, it's great to see you.
Hello, Jung, how are you today?
So what do you have for us today?
Okay, first we'll talk about how police are looking to charge three young men with attempting to murder their female acquaintance during a weekend outing. Next, we'll discuss the first large-scale follow-up study that was conducted on East Asian participants on the major benefits of coffee consumption. And lastly, we'll delve into even more controversy surrounding pro volleyball player Lee Da-young.
Okay, let's get started with our first story then, and it's a rather terrifying story of a botched murder attempt. Can you tell us more?
Yes, so the first story comes from an announcement on Sunday by the Hwasun Police Station located in Jeolla Province. Three 19-year-old males have been detained and will likely be charged for attempting to murder a 19-year-old female acquaintance this past weekend. It was apparently done so in an attempt to seize her insurance money.
Okay, so can you walk us through what happened exactly?
So before we get into the incident, it's important to talk about how they know each other. The victim was actually in a relationship, or so she thought, with one of the young men whom she had met through an online dating app last May. That's how she became acquainted with the two others. The four were lodged near Mount Beggar, and at around 11 p.m. Saturday, her supposed boyfriend said he prepared a surprise gift for her, but she had to find it herself about 1 kilometer away from the lodge. When she arrived at the spot, she found no gift, but one of the other men wielding a weapon with intent to kill. Luckily, the weapon broke during the attack, and the victim was able to escape.
So that is very, very fortunate for the young woman. So what happened next?
So people around her heard the victim screaming and called for help. Luckily, she was rushed to the hospital and both the boyfriend and the weapon-wielding attacker were caught soon after. The third male fled but was eventually caught in Suncheon, South Jeolla Province. The police are now applying for an arrest warrant for the three. Police added that the so-called boyfriend only selected the young woman as a target and designated her insurance beneficiary as himself, as he could pay off his car installments.
Wow, all that just to pay off his car installments. That is unbelievable. Well, thankfully, it didn't go as planned and the men have been caught. Let's move on to our next trending story. What do you have for us?
Okay, according to the interesting results of a 12.5-year-long study that came out on Sunday, coffee consumption may significantly lower the risk of death. It was a joint research by Seoul National University's Department of Food and Nutrition and the Department of Preventive Medicine on 330,000 people from four East Asian countries, including South Korea, Japan, China, and Singapore. The results have since been published in the recent issue of the International Journal of Epidemiology. Though similar studies have been conducted in Western countries, such as the US and others in Europe, this is the first for a large-scale follow-up study to have been conducted on participants from East Asian countries.
I see. So, Walter, what can you tell us about the research itself and what it found exactly?
Okay, so 38 researchers compared and analysed the risk of death by each gender through dividing participants' daily coffee intake into 1 to 3 cups, 3 to 5 cups, or 5 or more cups. Results showed that coffee consumption reduced the risk of death for Asians by 24% for men and 28% for women. The research team estimated that the physiologically active substances within coffee, such as chlorogenic acid, caffeine, magnesium, and more, actually exerts antioxidant and anti-inflammatory effects, which in turn improves blood sugar levels. The research also found that coffee intake can lower cancer and cardiovascular disease mortality rates.
Right, some interesting results there indeed. But what did the research and experts have to say themselves on the finding, as well as their plausibility? Because we are often hearing that coffee can be bad for your health too.
Right. So Professor Kang Dae-hee, a preventive medicine at Seoul National University College of Medicine, said that the research on the correlation between coffee and death has been repeatedly conducted around the world. And although some studies have proven the side effects of coffee, the recent research is more reliable considering its long-term observational study that collected an abundance of evidence.
Right, so the size and length of the study is certainly compelling, but I still think moderation is probably sensible, as this probably still cannot be considered definitive proof that coffee is always good for you. Okay, let's move on to our last story, shall we?
Yes, so more controversy surrounds disgraced professional Korean volleyball twin sisters, particularly the younger of the two, Lee Dae-young. The 25-year-old is in a heated dispute with her husband, referred to his surname Cho, over allegations of her domestic violence as well as money-related issues. In fact, it wasn't until this broke out did the South Korean public find out that Lee was actually married at all, as she had essentially led on that she has been unwed.
Right, for those unfamiliar, Lee Dae-young was suspended from the Korea Volleyball Federation along with her older twin sister, Lee Jae-young, over serious school bullying allegations. The two have since signed deals to play in Greece, but it looks like a new controversy has arisen concerning Lee Dae-young. So how did this all come to light then?
Well, it all started last Friday when Cho said in an interview with a media outlet that he is receiving psychiatric treatment after suffering from persistent verbal abuse and assault from Lee. Cho also revealed text messages between him and Lee where she was spewing profanities at her husband. The public was shocked when Cho came forward as they were unaware of Lee's marital status. However, Cho stated that the two tied the knot in April 2018, just after 3 months of dating.
Yeah, so she had a secret marriage unbeknownst to the public. This really did come as a surprise, especially considering the fact that she made a comment on a TV show just last year about how she is never going to get married. Has there been a response from Lee since these allegations by Cho surfaced?
Well, she hasn't directly responded, but through her legal representative, Sejong Law Firm, the firm has said in a press release on Saturday that Lee had separated with her husband after being married for about 4 months. The firm said that both parties agreed to a divorce, which hasn't been officially finalized yet. Yet Jo had repeatedly asked Lee's economic assets as her real estate as a prerequisite for the divorce.
Right, I understand that Cho has responded to that last part about the real estate issues as well.
Yes, he has. So Cho claimed later on Saturday that the economic demands were merely his request for basic living expenses, as he had paid for the house and living expenses while they lived together. Cho also said that he tried to change Lee's mind when they were asked to stay together, as he still cared for her, and he didn't want the word divorce associated with him. So Jo added that since they've been married, Lee had open affairs several times and told Jo that he should do the same if he thought it was unfair.
Yeah, so it looks like all her dirty laundry is getting aired in public and it will likely damage her public image even further here in Korea. Well, we have to leave it there for Korea Trending. Walter, thank you for those stories and we'll see you again later this week.
See you later this week.
It's time for Monday Sports Roundup, bringing you the latest updates and previews from the world of Korean sport. Joining me now for that is the ever hardworking sports journalist Yoo Ji-ho from the Yonhap News Agency. Ji-ho, it's great to speak to you again.
Yeah, it's great to be here too.
Now, Sunday turned out to be a big day for Korean golf. That's because two Korean golfers, Ko Jin-young and Im Sung-jae, both recorded victories on the LPGA and PGA Tours, respectively, on the same day. And they both won by four strokes as well. Let's first talk about Ko's title in the Cognizant Founders Cup in New Jersey. Ji-ho, can you tell us how it went down?
Yeah, Ko Jin-young went wire to wire to win this tournament out in New Jersey for her third title of the season and 10th of her career. She shot a 5-under 6-6 in the final round to cruise to a four-shot victory at 18 under par. So she's got three wins in her last six starts. This is a span that includes a runner-up finish and a top six finish. So she's been very hot in the second half, especially after the Olympics in Tokyo. She has also tied Annika Sorenstam's record by shooting in the 60s in 14 rounds in a row. And she can break the record in her next tournament, which will be the BMW Ladies Championship in the Korean city of Busan, which starts next week. So Ko Jin-young joins world number one Nelly Korda as the only three-time winners this year in LPGA. Ko is also making the Player of the Year points race a little more interesting. The gap has narrowed to 161 to 146, still in favor of Korda. But Korda will not play in Korea next week, and Ko has an excellent chance of surpassing the American, who actually brought her down from the number one ranking in the world earlier this year. Mm. So Ko is the fifth Korean player to reach double figures in career LPGA titles after Park Se-ri, who's got 25. Park Inbi is still active, 21 wins. Kim Tae-young, 12. And Shin Ji-hae, 11. And, you know, this is only Ko's fourth full season in LPGA, and she's only 26 years old. So she keeps it up. You know, she's going to close in on the, I guess, all-time record of 25 wins by Park Se-ri.
Right, it's great to see that she's finishing off so strongly, considering the fact that it had been a relatively quiet season for Korean women golfers this year, right, Ji-ho?
Right, you know, none of them won a major this year, and you know, this is after Koreans won three out of the four majors last year, and the pandemic interrupted the season when only four out of five majors were played, and Koreans won three of them. So this year, especially heading into the Olympics, you know, there was a lot of hand-wringing about how Korean players were struggling. And it kind of manifested itself in the Olympics when Korean golfers failed to win a medal. But afterward, you know, looking at Ko Jin-young, she actually skipped one of the majors, Women's British Open. She, you know, went back to work on her mechanics a little bit, changed the putter, came back, you know, winning three times out of six tournaments. So that really changed her season, turned it around. And she's in great form going into the final stretch. We've got the only tournament being held in Korea each year, the only Asian tournament this year in Busan in next week, and then a couple more events in Florida to wrap up the season. And she's in great position now to finish the season really strong.
Let's turn to the men's game now and about Im Sung-jae, who got his second career title at the Shriners Children's Open in Las Vegas. He was, in fact, three back of the lead heading into the final round, but then shot a blistering 62 to claim the title. It was an incredible last round, wasn't it, Ji-ho?
Yeah, he really caught fire down the stretch. And nine birdies and no bogeys. Had five birdies in a row starting in the ninth hole. And he was in such a zone that he said later he didn't know he had made five straight birdies. He was just playing out of his mind out in the TPC Thermal in Las Vegas. So, you know, if you look back on his career, he got his first win in his 50th tournament in March 2020, just before the tour shut down because of the pandemic. And he got his second win in his 100th tournament. So a bit of a nice bookend there between those two events. And, you know, in between, there's a lot of tournaments if you think about it. And he said he battled some little bit of self-doubt, wondering when or if the second would ever come. And I guess he got the answer today. He said he was able to stay calm. And once he realized, he opened up a little bit of a gap between himself and the rest of the tournament, rest of the field. He relaxed a little more coming down the stretch. So a very talented player. He's a workhorse. He plays every week, it seems. I think consistently leads the tour in rounds played ever since he's been a rookie. So he gives himself a chance week in and week out. He's always had the talent. I think he's gotten over the mental hump this week to win it, coming from behind. And it's a great sign early in the season for him.
Right, we commented previously about a month ago, I think, about how despite his consistent and impressive performances, we still want to see him finish higher up the leaderboards and to see him win some more titles. And he looks like he's done just that now. And at just age 23, he does seem to have a really exciting future ahead of him as well, it seems, Gio.
I agree. And, you know, I think last year he got a tough break with the pandemic because, you know, he won 1 week. And then the following week, I think he was finished third at the Arnold Palmer tournament. And then the tour shut down for whatever months because of the pandemic. So he really lost the rhythm. And he admitted today that he talked about the stretch where he came back. He had a little bit of a trouble, you know, getting back into the groove of things. And if he had been able to just keep on playing, I think the last season would have turned out a lot better for him. So, but you know what? I think he's put it behind. He played in the Tour Championship last year. And, you know, this is tournament number three for the new season, and he won it. So this might be the case of maybe the floodgate being open for the young guy.
Yeah, so a great day for Korean golf, and let's hope we see plenty more. OK, let's move on to football now, where South Korea's men's national team will face their biggest challenge yet in the final World Cup qualifying round. The Taeguk Warriors are in Tehran this week to take on Iran in Group A action Tuesday night. And this is the battle of the two top nations in the group. Can you set up for us, Jiho?
Yeah, 10:30 p.m. kickoff Tuesday night in Korean time. You know, Korea eked out a 2-1 win over Syria last Thursday at home behind captain Son Heung-min's last-minute winner. So two wins and a draw after three matches at home. Korean ranking currently in second place in Group A. So Iran defeating UAE 1-0 also Thursday to extend the winning streak to three matches. So they've got five goals scored, none conceded so far as they sit atop Group A. Now, Korea has never defeated Iran in Tehran. So it's two draws and five losses so far. So that's the kind of draw that they like to end to this time. But Korea really didn't impress much against Syria. Came within minutes of really settling for a draw that would have felt like a loss on home soil. So there was another disappointing event, a turn of events for Korea. And also, I guess one kind of saving grace for Korea is that there will not be any fans at Azadi Stadium in Tehran after all. Mm. There were some reports, so at least a bit of a speculation that they're going to have 10,000 fans. But they didn't end up getting the final approval from either FIFA or AFC. So it's going to be held behind the closed doors. So it's not going to be as hostile as maybe Korean players might have feared in the first place.
Right, so no fans, and do you understand no VAR either?
No VAR, right.
The Iran FA couldn't get that sorted in time, right?
Mm, I mean, they've got the sanctions issue, so they couldn't get the equipment across the border for some reason. So no VAR, hopefully nothing controversial happens in that match either side. Mm. You don't want a match of that magnitude being decided on some controversial play. And I don't think I can stress enough not having any fans. Like, that's a pretty important thing, I think, for the Korean team, for any visitors in that stadium, because that place can be really hostile. 10,000, whatever number, screaming fans.
Sure.
Just the way the stadium is set up, it can be pretty intimidating, especially for players who haven't played there. But to do it in front of empty stadium, Korean players are already used to it. They've done it three times at home already. So it's going to be more neutral atmosphere for the visitors this time.
Sure. So this is going to be Korea's toughest test in the group. Any predictions, Jiho? The mood surrounding the national team isn't great at the moment, is it?
No, it's not great, but I don't know. This might be the time for them to, you know, flip the narrative, if you will. I don't know if Korea have what it takes to win this time, to be honest. I don't want to be too much of a pessimist.
Mm.
But I'd be very surprised if Korea pulled out a win this time. Let's put it that way.
Yes, that seems to be the belief that many are having at the moment. Anyway, that game between Korea and Iran will take place Tuesday night, 10:30 p.m. Korea time. Let's quickly finish up with some news from the Major League Baseball postseason. After the St. Louis Cardinals were knocked out by the Los Angeles Dodgers in the National League wildcard game, with Kim Kwang-hyun watching from the bullpen, Chejiman of the Tampa Bay Rays was the last Korean standing in the MLB postseason. And on Sunday, the Rays lost to the Boston Red Sox on the road. Chess started, but he didn't have a hit in two trips to the plate. The team now faces elimination, so it's not looking great to say the least, right, Jiho?
No, their back is against the wall, if you will. Chejiman going 0-for-2 with a strikeout and getting lifted for a pinch hitter in the sixth inning. So this is Choi Ji-man's first start this postseason with righty Nathan Eovaldi starting for the Red Sox. He hit a homer in game two after coming off the bench, but the Rays lost that game 14-6. Now, this game, they lost 6-4 in 13 innings as Christian Vasquez hit a 2-1 walk-off homer in the bottom 13th at Fenway. So, you know, the Rays, they were down. They tied the score with a two-spot in the eighth inning, you know, forced the things into extra innings, but ended up losing that game. Now face elimination tomorrow morning in game four back in Fenway.
Well, that's all for our Monday Sports Roundup this week. Jiho, thank you as always for those updates, and we'll talk to you again next week.
Okay, thanks for having me.
This is Swiss flutist Philipp Jund. I am professor of flute at Neuchâtel Conservatory in Switzerland and at Gangnam University in Korea. You are listening to Korea 24.
We finish up the show as usual with our closing segment, Morning Edition Preview, looking at some interesting features or reports coming out in tomorrow's editions of the Korea Times and the Korea Herald newspapers. Our staff editor, Mark Wilson Chair, has been looking through those papers for us, and he's joined us now in the studio. Mark, hello. It's great to see you.
Good to see you, too.
So what do you have for us today?
We're going to head to the Korea Times as Lee Hae-in writes about an online post that is drawing quite a bit of attention. The woman who posted this story claims that a particular health center located in Suwon, Gyeonggi Province, essentially forced pregnant women to vow to breastfeed their babies when they registered their pregnancy to receive welfare benefits. It became an issue when the friend of the poster, who refused to sign it, saying that she didn't believe breastfeeding was a must and that it was her choice to do it. Following this, said the poster, the center treated her friend like, quote, a weird person. The vow itself reads, I vow to breastfeed. I vow to know the importance of breastfeeding and raise my child healthily. I vow to continue breastfeeding even after going back to work.
Wow, that is a rather shocking statement to be asked to sign.
Well, he writes that apparently, as a means to promote breastfeeding, a number of public health centers here require the written pledge from pregnant women who visit to register and receive welfare benefits, including free prenatal tests and iron supplement pills. Now, an official from a public health center here in Seoul told The Times that this breastfeeding vow campaign is part of the Korea Health Promotion Institution's health plan guidelines and aims to promote the health benefits of breastfeeding to mothers and their children. But obstetricians point out that the campaign is discriminatory and lacks understanding of women's health, as many pregnant women cannot breastfeed due to health issues. This is a very, it's quite a deep article. It's not very long, but it's very deep, and I really encourage people to check it out tomorrow's Times.
Right. It's not just about whether they have health problems, whether they can breastfeed or not, but it's about for women who don't want to do it, if perhaps whether their working conditions might not make it workable. And actually, it's more than that. It's just about choice. Women shouldn't have to feel that they're being judged if they're not breastfeeding. It sounds like a very misguided and outdated plan, and serious questions will need to be asked about it. Let's move on to our second story. What do you have for us?
Song Seung-hyun writes in the Korea Herald about the Korean Cultural Center UK, announcing that it will hold the 16th London Korean Film Festival for 2 weeks from November 4th to the 19th. 35 Korean films of diverse genres will be screened, including indie films, classic films, animations, and shorts. Now, last year, Song writes, the annual event was held as an online-offline hybrid festival due to the COVID-19 pandemic, of course. But this year, all the films will be screened at 9 local theaters in London.
Yes, I've been to the festival myself when I was living there my past life. So what are some of the films that will be featured at the festival this year?
The opener will be Escape from Mogadishu, directed by Ryu Sung-hwan. That was recently picked as South Korea's entry for Best International Feature category of the 94th Academy Awards, by the way. The closing film will be Heaven to the Land of Happiness, directed by Im Sang-soo. Also, a KBS documentary on Oscar winner Yoon Yeo-jung will also be screened for audiences who want to take a look at Yoon's career. And judging by, if we remember her BAFTA acceptance speech, I feel like London will really get a kick out of it. So, yeah.
I'm sure. We'll have to wrap it up there. Thank you for those stories, Mark, and we'll talk to you next time.
Talk to you then.
Well, that concludes our show for today. Thank you for staying with us. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow, so do join us again then. I've been your host, Kwon Jang-ho, and thank you, as always, for listening. Goodbye. Mm-hmm.